Thank you. It is a great pleasure to address the Global Security Forum. I've been to a few meetings here myself, and I know that this is a forum in which anything can be said. And it's a place where lots of ideas can germinate, and frankness is valued, and that's what I intend to honour. There are also members of the audience who know at least as much about national security strategies as I do, and so I hope that my comments may act as a stimulus to their own questions and comments. And the topic that the way I phrased this topic was British security problems, new environment, old problems, in the sense that it seems to me that we are facing new issues with still an awful lot of legacy issues, a lot of legacy, which make it really quite difficult to, as it were, achieve the policy coherence that we want to achieve. And I thought what I'd do is just say something about each side of that equation, new environment, old problems. And on new environment, like all scholars of international politics, I spend quite a lot of time reading about the new security challenges, and I think we're all fairly familiar with what those security challenges are supposed to be. International crime is certainly a degree of challenge, terrorism, environmental stress, developmental issues, cyber threats, sheer complexity is to a degree a new security problem. I don't intend to go through those things. We can talk about them by all means later on, but it seems to me those are a given in any contemporary discussion of security problems. What I think is quite interesting is this concept of securitization. When we talk about securitization, what do we choose to make into a security problem? And I'm a great believer in this case in what's in our business is known as the Copenhagen School, based on the University of Copenhagen and some of the institutes in Copenhagen, which is the idea that of security is it's partly perceptual. A security problem is that which we say we have to address with extraordinary resources and extraordinary attention so that we can get on with the rest of our lives. Unless we deal with that out there, we cannot live our lives normally. So if that out there is domination by a foreign power, or is an environmental threat, or is cyber terrorism, or is terrorism, whatever it is, if we judge, if our public judges that it's stopping us getting on with our normal lives, then we have to address it as a security problem. That's the securitization of issues. And I think that when we think about new security problems, crime and environmental issues and so on, that's what we're really doing. What we're discussing is to what extent do we need to take these as special issues? To what extent do we need to devote special resources, special attention, so that we can keep it over there or we can deal with it and get on with the rest of our lives? That's securitization. And I think there's lots of interesting arguments about that, and I don't intend to go through them in this lecture. But I'm actually interested in deeper trends, not just the question of what do we securitize, but what else is happening in world politics that leads us to think that there is a new environment out there that we have to take seriously. I think there's two or three things. First of all, and this is fairly conventional I think, our international institutions are uniquely weak at the moment for all sorts of reasons connected with the end of the Cold War, globalization, changing structures of power in world politics. We have a set of international institutions from the UN through to the World Trade Organization, through to NATO, through the EU, which are basically weak, which are in need of change or reform, in some cases abolition, but we cannot put our faith in institutional behavior in the way that we could even 20 years ago. And that's not surprising. When systems change, when great sea changes take place in world politics, inevitably, behaviour and institutions are in a dynamic relationship. After all, during the Cold War in the 50s and 60s, politics, international politics, moved really rather slowly because they were very institutionalised. It took years to get something argued through NATO, but when it was argued through, like the decision on flexible response, change in NATO strategy, took 4 or 5 years to argue it through, but when it was argued through, it was done. There was a new strategy. It took time because the institutions, as it were, conditioned political behaviour. But we're now in the reverse of that. Political behaviour takes place for unilateral reasons, for balance of power reasons, and the institutions are having to shape themselves around it. So there has been a reversal. And that's one deeper change in the environment, which is quite difficult for Britain, who's always been very committed to international institutions, quite difficult for us to get used to. Second bigger change, I think, is a weaker political consensus in the Western world. Political consensus about action, about values, about threats that we should take seriously to the system or to our security. Again, it's easy to use the Cold War as the comparator, but even if we go before the Cold War, if we think about even the 1930s and 20s, think about the late 19th century, I cannot think of a time in my understanding of international history over the last century and a half when the major Western countries were less consensual about what their security should be about. Now, that may turn out to be a temporary phenomenon. That might just be the hiatus between two international orders. But we're stuck with it, and I rather suspect we might be stuck with it for quite a long time. And that, I think, is a second, a deeper trend, which is very disturbing to Britain, because we have always been, first of all, a leader of the consensus, then a shaper of the consensus, then a follower of the consensus. A consensus on values and ideas about the international political system is very important to us. And a third, deeper trend, and this really is the essence of the problem, is globalization. We all talk about globalization, we use it as a convenient shorthand for lots of different things, and again, I don't propose to argue about the meaning of globalization, though we could have a very interesting talk about it. But the point is, globalization is a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon. It is not a political system. It is, if you like, a fact of life. It is morally fairly neutral, in the sense that it's an economic, social, and communications phenomenon. I always think that globalization is a bit like a train leaving the station. If you get on the train, you will somehow benefit from globalization in due course. But if you miss the train, you'll never get on it. And it's leaving the station. It's halfway down the platform and accelerating all the time. It is a fact of life. It doesn't carry any particular political principles within it. Now, that's something that a lot of people would disagree with, but I would argue that that is the case. Just one little vignette of globalization, which I think is important and interesting. We always think of globalization as a great leveller of cultures, the homogenization of culture, the McDonaldization of world culture. We think of globalization as a way in which cultures are somehow diminished. But remember too that the same forces of globalization that gives you McDonald's on every corner also gives you the ability to connect with your own culture in the way that you want to. You can go to immigrant communities anywhere in the world and find immigrant communities reading their own newspapers, downloading their own material, looking at their own TV station through satellite, picking up their mobile phone to ring their mother-in-law. They can live in a society in a way that they couldn't have 50 years ago, even 30 years ago, without ever learning a word of that language. So it is the case that a Bengali family could live in Bradford quite happily and connect only to Bengali culture. They wouldn't have to actually even begin to integrate in the way that they would have had to a few years ago. In exactly the same way that an expat British person can live in Saudi Arabia or Abu Dhabi and not learn a word of Arabic, not be aware even of Arabic culture around them. Globalization gives you the ability to live in your little cyber bubble. And more than ever before, it seems to me, it gives you a choice of identities. That's one of the interesting questions about globalization. It allows people to choose, to a degree, the identity that they want to adopt. And that is part of what I take to be the sort of value-free basis of globalization. It is not, I think, despite a lot of writing to the contrary, a politically loaded system. It's a phenomenon. Now, what that means, that particular point, more specifically, is that the end of the Cold War and the phenomenon of globalization is not a victory for the liberal democracies. It was normal for us to say, oh, great, the Cold War is over and we succeeded in exactly the way we intended to succeed. And there's a degree of truth in that. The Cold War came to an end exactly as Harriman and Kennan and some of these architects of containment had assumed that it should. By containment, by peaceful competition, we will outproduce the Soviets. We will out-consumer them. They won't be able to keep up. Eventually, people will see that they're better off in this sort of system. There's a big element of that, but ultimately, that triumph of containment was overlaid by globalization. And the assumptions we used to make in the 1990s that, okay, the Cold War is over, liberal democracy has triumphed, and globalization will make liberal democracy unstoppable. And the Francis Fukuyama thesis, The End of History, was partly based on that. A great deal of writing in the 90s was based on the inevitability of capitalist liberal democracy being unstoppable in world politics. And that was a very persuasive thought. But here we are in 2008, and it's a less obvious thought now than it was then. Two of the great powers do not accept it. Russia and China are saying quite seriously, quite deliberately, that liberal democratic capitalism is not the prerequisite to economic development. For quite different reasons, Putin's Russia, Chinese leadership throughout three generations now has completely gone in a circle. And I mean, China is a very good example, it seems to me, of a country which has embarked on the great experiment, which is to say that we have found a model of economic development which is centrally led, consultative. It's not that we are just autocratic, we are consultative, but we're not democratic, because we are aware of what chaos democracies can bring. They're aware of what happened in the Soviet Union, aware of what happened in Russia in the 90s, and they're looking for ways to avoid being outspent by the United States. For instance, the Chinese always say that militarily they want to match the Americans, but they want to match them asymmetrically. They don't want to build a military machine the size of America, or they'll fall into the Soviet trap of trying to outspend them militarily. What the Chinese are looking for is an asymmetric way of countering their view of America's threat to them in the future without having to match all of their military hardware. And they're very interested in asymmetric warfare, anti-satellite weapons, cyber war, information war, psychological war. They're very interested in ways of negating America's power without spending America's sorts of amounts of money. So in Russia, China, in states in Africa, in some of the stands in Central Asia, this liberal democratic wave is absolutely stoppable. There has been some reversion on that. And China represents an enormous opportunity to a number of leaderships in Africa. Because what, in a sense, China is saying is, you don't have to be kicked around by the IMF. You don't have to be lectured to by Western powers, made conditional. We will give you this, we will give you that, no questions asked. And in any case, we offer an alternative model. And that's a very attractive option to a lot of African governments, some Asian governments, who have been lectured to, I think for very good reasons, by Western powers. So the basic point is that with all of the new security issues that we are aware of, there are some deeper structural trends taking place. And there's one book which I just wanted to point out to you, partly in fun actually, as this is an informal group. But it's a book I'm very fond of at the moment because it's so outrageous. Walter Russell Mead, God and Gold, came out last year in the States. And it's called America, Britain and the Making of the Modern World. And of course he's the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, a crusty old East Coast American conservative. But it is a brilliant book. It's outrageous in the right sense of the term. It is outrageous because it outrages everyone but Britain and America. Because he says in it, there are two basic ideas in this book. And let me just give them to you in essence from the introduction. It's well worth a read. He says, since the glorious revolution of 1688 that established parliamentary and Protestant rule in Britain, the Anglo-Americans have been on the winning side in every major international conflict. Right? The Anglo-Americans have been on the winning side in every major international conflict. The War of the League of Augsburg, the War of the Spanish Succession, the War of the Austrian Succession, the Seven Years' War, the American Revolution, Britain lost but America won, the French Revolutionary Wars, the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. These are the wars that made the Western world, and either the British or the Americans, or both, together they won every one of them. More than 300 years of unbroken victory, major wars with great powers, it begins to look almost like a pattern. And what he says is that essentially this dominance was based on, he says it's three sets of initials, UP, UK, US, United Provinces, United Kingdom, United States. The maritime empires, he says, basically made the rules. The great land empires, the French Revolutionary Empire, the Russian Empire, those great land empires didn't make the rules. The maritime empires made the rules. But this is his second point, and it also very outrageous. He says, the second observation is about Anglo-American power, that as their power has grown, the Anglo-Americans have more and more often been dead wrong about what their growing power and their military victories mean for the world. And what he's really saying is that the British and the Americans kept winning wars, but they didn't know why. So in other words, they have this sense, very, very Anglo-Saxon view, that if only we can win this war, then everything will somehow be fine. If we just win the First World War, just get rid of this German militarism, everything will be fine. Get rid of fascism, win this war against fascism, then we can settle down. Win the Cold War, we can settle down. You know, once the communists have gone, we settle down. Once we've beaten the terrorists, we'll get back to something. What? We don't know. And this is one of the things he's getting at, is that we don't really know what we stand for. We have had the effect, somewhat against our own better judgment sometimes, of, in a sense, making the international system, which is now changing. That's what he's getting at. And I think it's a very fair question. If you're French, if you're Arabic, if you're East Asian, you might say, you know, what has all this 300 years of military dominance, what has it been for? So that in freedom, you people can watch rubbish TV and eat junk food? Is that what Western freedom is actually all about? The sort of boorish peasant behaviour of Anglo-American societies? Is there not something greater in essence here? And it's a fair question. It's a fair question. You know, for what purposes has this international system had these rules created in favour of our commerce? Our commerce is somehow vulgar. Our commerce doesn't lead to any higher purpose. I mean, I've got my own answer to that question, but it is a fair question. Now, the reason I mention that is that it seems to me here is one conservative American essentially worrying about the fact that the present international system, 300 years old, rules made by the maritime empires, is somehow at an end. And unless the Anglosphere, as he calls it, this rather dominant Anglosphere, unless it knows what it stands for, then it won't be capable of exerting any real influence on the remaking of the rules which is taking place now. So that takes me just to the second issue, which is British security policy itself. Right? New environment, old problems. Somehow, British security policy, that is defence policy, foreign policy, aid policy, internal, justice, home office and so on, somehow security policy has got to navigate its way through all of this. After all, the British economy is still a very large economy. It's enjoyed 15 years of consecutive economic growth, employment for 29 million people. Its growth in the first half of 07 was over 3%, 3.25%. It's going to be less subsequently. But what we've got in this UK economy and society is, I think, a very globalised society. One thing that Britain is good at is understanding the implications of globalisation. We accept the multiculturalism that may imply. We accept the economic disruption that may imply. In a sense, I suspect that we're a cork on the international tide. When the world economy does well, we do pretty well. When the world economy goes into anything near a recession, we feel it more severely. We are more dependent on the international system than many of our partners, both economically and, I suspect, socially. So if the system really is changing, if our institutions, international institutions, are not very good, if the rules are being made elsewhere, if there is a deep underlying change in the nature of international society, how do we, a very open, globalised, dependent society, how do we cope with that? I think our problems fall into four. Let me just mention these four things briefly, and they'll be points for discussion, really. And I guess they're four dimensions of the same issue. And I raised these four partly in conversation with colleagues, but also as a result of, as I say, hanging around the bazaars of Whitehall for the last 20-odd years. I mean, the first problem is that we're quite good at coordination, But we're not so sure about the need for redefinition of our security. That is, faced with these new security problems, crime, environment, etc., etc., of course we say, yes, we've got to coordinate, we've got to bring Whitehall together, and by and large we're really quite good at that. But there is a real resistance to saying, well, how far have we got to redefine our security? Have we just got to, perhaps it's just a traditional problem, we just need to coordinate better. Now maybe that is true, but the question needs to be put, it seems to me, much more overtly. And the National Security Strategy, which I guess everyone here is aware of, is, in essence, as I understand it, is an attempt to try to reconceptualise or to conceptualise in a modern way what our task is. And we know that that was due to come out before Christmas. It hasn't yet appeared. We know it's subject to discussion in Whitehall. When that appears, it will be a very interesting document, because I think it is an attempt, at least at the top level, to say, let us address the question of whether we need to redefine our security. But that, to my knowledge, will be the first real attempt to ask that question. And whether it's asked successfully or not, I think, will be a very interesting point. That's the first issue. Coordination, yes, but we often allow coordination to get in the way of real definition. Sometimes I think British policy is beautifully coordinated, but just incoherent. Coordination is the policy sometimes. As long as we can get all of our ducks in a row, we think that's okay. We go to the ministerial meeting with that as our position. That's not the same as having a strategy, working out how to do it, and then deciding who shall line up in what order. Second point, which really, as I say, it's another dimension of that, is that the Whitehall bureaucratic cycle, as I call it, is not conducive even to deep coordination at the moment. It seems to me that we are worse in the UK than we were even 5 or 6 years ago at things like the comprehensive approach, as we now call it. I mean, I've sat and heard Foreign Office officials in private meetings say, when I talk about this, and they say, oh, no, you're wrong. Look at what we've achieved in Afghanistan. We've just got this, and we've just got that, and we've been able to get the NGOs on board, and we've coordinated DFID and Foreign Office and the military. And it's really, we're very pleased about it. And I say, yeah, absolutely right, and I'm pleased too. So we're back to where we were in 1999 in Kosovo. We've got back to square one. Now, to be fair, Kosovo was a small case. Afghanistan is a very big case that came off the back of a different thing. Kosovo was always going to be a complex emergency. Afghanistan started as a more conventional counterinsurgency guerrilla war and has come from different antecedents. But the fact is, all of those lessons which were painfully learned in the 90s in Bosnia and Kosovo and Albania and East Timor and so on, those lessons which were all there were somehow submerged when we went to the bigger cases of Iraq and Afghanistan. And with progress and a great deal of determination and commitment, in those bigger cases, we're now back where we were conceptually about 10 years ago. And it seems to me that that's a very interesting and indicative symptom of the problem we face. That in the third term of a government that's under pressure, which may or may not win the next election, which is more and more neuralgic about headlines, as governments in third terms tend to be, with a tight spending round and the economy not necessarily going into a 16th consecutive year of growth, all of those elements create a sort of bureaucratic cycle in Whitehall which take a lot of the inventiveness out of the system. They take a lot of give and take. They make bureaucrats retrench and they make people fairly, I was going to say short-sighted, but it brings their horizons in. It's much more difficult to get Whitehall buy-in in this phase than it was 5 or 6 years ago, and certainly there was a lot of Whitehall buy-in in 97, 98, 99. The incoming Labour government was determined to change things, and quite a lot of things did change in Whitehall in all sorts of, I think, for me, quite good ways. That's not the case now. So that sort of retrenchment, I think, has got to be taken seriously. The bureaucratic cycle just doesn't go with the grain at the moment. A third old problem is the old chestnut of resources and commitments. And it's not just budgetary issues. Of course, the budgetary issues are pretty severe at the moment, and we're used to those. Defence is feeling very hard done to at the moment, but so are other areas of public expenditure in relation to external affairs. The most relaxed is DFID, who have a pretty big budget for the sort of things they were doing, And they have, it seems to me, that DFID, with all the problems that that department raises, has done a pretty good job. People get very annoyed with it in Whitehall, but in the rest of the world, it's done a lot more than the old ODI was able to do with smaller resources and so on. So budget issues are there, but it's not only that. I think we've got a bigger issue on resources and commitments, and it comes back to something we've been talking about in Russia recently, which is that during the Cold War, defence always made the very sensible assumption that we prepare for major war. Of course we did. We prepared for major war in Europe with total mobilisation. And the view was, if you prepare for big wars, then you can do everything else. You can do the smaller things if you can do the big thing. And during the Cold War, that had to be the assumption. That it made no sense to make any other assumption. But of course, that assumption has persisted now for some time, for 18-odd years after the end of the Cold War, 17-odd years. And one wonders about the big war assumption. Remember also that the big war assumption is also an automatic vote in favour of big ticket items, of the, you know, the most major systems in air, land and maritime systems. But it raises the question as to whether in lesser operations, whether the adapting the big war machine to smaller events really is the most economic and cost-effective way of doing it. And the Ministry of Defence has tried to turn the equation around a little bit by saying that, well, we don't now plan at divisional level. We don't plan at army group or divisional level. We plan at brigade level, which is, you know, roughly 5,000. And we plan to be able to deploy brigades, which is about right for the sort of things the army and the forces find themselves doing. And we plan in such a way that we can put the brigades together if we ever need to go back to the big level. It's easy to say, but it doesn't quite work that way. And it seems to me that we've got a bit of a mismatch between the structures on paper of battle groups and brigades and the equipment program and what it is we're bringing on stream. We had a very good meeting in Russia last week, which I'll simply paying tribute to Hugh Strawn, who actually I think made some very good points about our counterinsurgency strategy. And he said what we really need for counterinsurgency is much more attention to information operations, and he's absolutely right in that. We regard them as an extra to operate to real kinetic operations, real fighting, but they're not. They're fundamental to it. We need much more understanding of what an insurgency is about, and something he didn't say, but I do, is that the target is not the insurgents, it's the insurgency. The target is not the people, that is the people who are carrying guns. The target is the phenomenon of the insurgency. That's fundamental, and that requires a much, much better balance of resources than we have given. I guess what it all comes down to, and I do pay tribute to Hugh Strawn for this point, and I think he expressed it very well, he said that when we talk about counterinsurgency and what the forces really do, we concentrate all the time on tactics. You know, if we only get our tactics right, we'll be okay. But in fact, we don't think enough about what is it the insurgency is trying to achieve, what can we do to counter that, what is it about. It's not just tactics, it's a much more political analysis act involved in the process. And the final point, the final problem, the final inflexibility, I think, which leaves us somewhat stranded in this new world, is our own problems, inevitable I suppose, in getting the balance between our transatlantic commitments and our European destiny, whatever that might be. On the one hand, it is clear that US long-term interests in the world are shifting. The old Atlantic alliance, the old sort of thing that Mead is talking about in the Anglosphere, that is changing. It's bound to change. Doesn't mean to say it's disappeared, but it is changing. And so we have to accept that in the long term, US interests are likely to change, and we have to think that through. On the other hand, we have a European Union of 27 countries, 490 million people, 25% of global GDP comes out of the European Union. We can't regard that as somehow trivial. And if that 27 countries and 490 million people doesn't count as some sort of actor in the world, then it would be very curious. I mean, sooner or later, that grouping or that concentration of economic and social power has got to find more expression than it has had so far. I think that's what any political analyst would say, regardless of whether we like it or not. And that balance is very difficult. And I think Britain has been in a very confused state of mind. And again, let me just give you my finally, my view running around the bazaars of Whitehall as to how this plays out. If you go to the Foreign Office and talk to Foreign Office officials, I think they're very comfortable in a way they would never were 10 or 15 years ago with the idea that US interests are changing and that we've got to think much more flexibly about how the transatlantic relationship can be reinterpreted, what we can do for it, how we can renegotiate it from our own point of view. If you go to the political side of the Ministry of Defence, policy planning and so on, you find something similar, more nuanced, but something similar. You go to the armed forces and they hide under the table. The idea of not being close to the Americans is anathema to the armed forces, because they say, well, you know, look at the intelligence sharing, look at the nuclear sharing, look at the friendship between our forces, look at how well we get on. And that's all true. It's all true. But what the military sees is that they see what they would lose in a fracture of that practical relationship. They're not convinced that there would be much to gain from accepting a change in the transatlantic relationship. And I see that all the time in Whitehall. When people say, how does Whitehall feel about it? I always say, rather like the States in this case, it depends who you talk to. And I use that only as a vignette of the wider questions and in some cases confusions in our society. Now, I've got my own views as to how we might resolve that, but I'll keep those to myself until question time. Ultimately, it seems to me that this is a very, very interesting time to be studying British security policy. It's a miserable time to be making it, absolutely miserable time to be a policymaker. It's a great time to be an analyst, since this is the transition between two international systems. And whereas the old system was one that played to Britain's strengths, the Cold War was really very good for Britain. It played to our strengths. It made us more important than we might otherwise have been. The international system of the 21st century does not naturally play to our strengths, and I think we will have to look much harder for those areas of strength than hitherto in order to exploit them. There are plenty of things there, and I come back to the way in which we interpret being an actor which can cope with globalisation. For me, that becomes the pillar upon which I would like to explore the sort of strengths that we might have to offer. Thank you.